This is a production of Cornell University.
Thanks, Christine, not just for the introduction, but for hosting me here. And my thanks to Phil Liu, my classmate from graduate school. For me, it's really wonderful to be here at Cornell, not only to see those two people, but Pete Laux and Jerry Stettinger, others that I've known for decades, even though you couldn't imagine that we would be old enough to know each other for decades. Thank you very much for coming here for this discussion. And I do intend it to be a discussion. I'll try to keep my remarks reasonably short, given I do have a lot to say. I'm going to aim for about 40 minutes or so and then leave plenty of time for questions and answers and to hear what you have to say. Let me give you the context for both how I came to be involved in shale gas policy and practice and sort of where I'm coming from, if I can put it that way. First of all, I'm no shale gas expert. You heard I'm a water resource systems person, which of course is highly relevant to the impacts of shale gas development. But I have not worked it and I haven't done research on it. What I was a president of a university with an environmental background. And there were two activities that I'll be talking about that needed chairs. People who would tend to be viewed as objective and neutral, and who might actually know something or have a technical background that was relevant to the topic. So I got drafted into both of these contexts, both of these activities, primarily because of the position I occupied and my background, rather than anything I've done or any positions I've taken. So keep that in mind. Second of all, the context or the premise from which I'm approaching the shale gas problem or opportunity is it's happening anyhow, as it is in my state. Let's make sure it happens in a way that has as little environmental impact as possible and produces as much economic value for our region as possible. I'm not here to address the question of whether we should develop shale gas, though you'll see the details I'll be talking about, the environmental impacts and the economic benefits, mostly the impacts, of course, factor significantly into whether or not one should pursue shale gas development in a particular location. But that's not the question I'm taking on. Having said that, though, I do want to make one point. There are a lot of arguments, I don't want you to look at that yet, because you won't listen to me. There are a lot of arguments for and against. Now, you knew I would do that. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
I'll try not to use my hands. There are a lot of arguments for and against shale gas, sort of macro arguments. One, for example, is we should not develop a new plentiful fossil fuel source when we all know we need to convert or transition to a fossil-free or much reduced fossil-dependent energy future. So we shouldn't develop that. That's one argument. There's something that's forgotten in this, and to me it's very important in part because I've worked on this aspect of the problem and it's highly relevant to my region. So this map comes from a report from a committee that I chaired for the National Research Council. And that was a committee that was charged with estimating, quantifying the externalities, the external impacts from energy production and use in America. Our charge was not, by the way, to talk about the methodology for quantifying externalities, but to actually come up with estimates. And we did, remarkably, in 12 months. It was quite an effort. What this map shows you is the location of damages in dollar terms from the external impacts of using coal to produce electricity. And the bigger the circle, the more the impacts. Total annual impacts, we estimated, was $60 billion of external costs, almost entirely or very much from human health impacts. premature death and disease. And you'll see there's a big concentration of this in western Pennsylvania, which shouldn't be a surprise because we're very dependent on using coal to generate electricity in our region. To the extent that shale gas is used to substitute for coal in generating electricity, and it has been quite rapidly in our region, there are great environmental and human health gains to be had. So that should be a factor in our deciding whether or not shale gas is worth developing. Please don't forget that. All right, so that's all I'm going to say about whether you should do shale gas. Now I'm coming from the perspective that it's happening, and it is very significantly in my region of western Pennsylvania. How can we have it happen or produce the best outcomes that we can? I was involved in two activities. The first one was a roundtable under the auspices of the Institute of Politics of the University of Pittsburgh, the Shale Gas Roundtable, and I co-chaired it. Its purpose, this is a disclaimer. We had elected officials on our roundtable and representatives of companies, et cetera. And you can read the disclaimer if you want, but it basically allows any member to say, well, I didn't exactly agree with that recommendation, even though I signed the report. So I've done my duty. It was a big roundtable. It was intentionally chosen to represent multiple sectors. The geography of our region of southwest Pennsylvania. We spent 2 years benchmarking and developing our recommendations, and we developed 8 what we called core recommendations and then several more under 4 different areas that I'll tell you about. Here's the membership. Let me just flag a few. Karen Glatfelty, the former environmental program manager for the Heinz Endowments. This Patrick Henderson is the energy czar for the state of Pennsylvania. It was notable that he was a very active member of this group, as was Scott Perry from the Department of Environmental Protection, who's the senior oil and gas person within DEP. Nature Conservancy was represented, Chevron, EQT, Consol is on there, Ducks Unlimited, et cetera. So, and we had some elected officials, state senator, 2 state representatives, a county commissioner. So that was the group. First of all, our focus, of course, is on the Marcellus Shale. Not of course, it is. And it's shown here, it's the area outlined in bluish purple. The Utica is the one in purple that underlies the Marcellus, and of course, the Marcellus is very significant in New York State. It is the largest shale play in America in terms of its natural gas reserves. So it's very significant in general, but very significant to the region that I'm from. This helps me not only show the Marcellus in Pennsylvania, but show you the region as we define it. It's the 10 counties, starting with Greene and Fayette, and going up like here. Pittsburgh is in Allegheny County, where Carnegie Mellon is located. I show you this to underscore how rapidly shale gas development is occurring and has occurred in southwest Pennsylvania. So you'll see this is the total number of permits issued for drilling over that time period, 2001-2012, and these are the last 3 years of that period. 75% of all the permits were issued in those 3 years out of those 13 years. Also, you'll see that southwest Pennsylvania is a growing fraction of the total shale gas production, these are permits, but it's also true for production in the state, owing to the fact that our part of the Marcellus formation tends to produce relatively wetter gas, gas with the constituents in it that are valuable for petrochemical processing. All right, so this is a good way of conveying what I said before. The question we pose for ourselves is, it's happening. How can we safeguard our communities and our environment while growing the economy, getting the economic benefits from this gas production, and recognizing that impacts will happen. We're not going to get all the economic value from it. What kind of trade-offs need to be made, and those are not clear, and people disagree about them, as they should. Putting it another way, we want to get it right. But we also understood that getting it right is a complicated thing. But we identified what we thought would be key ingredients for ever getting it right: a strong state regulatory system, the use of best management practices by industry, innovation — it's an interesting question in this regard — continuing technological innovation to improve the process, and the need for more research. This is something I'll talk quite a bit more about, because it's something we came to focus on as a roundtable. I said that there were eight core recommendations, but that there were four — well, let me put it another way. The way we approached this was, so having posed the question and creating the framework for ourselves, we then identified four areas of focus as a way to pursue our work. And we created work groups around each of these four. From their work emerged these eight overall recommendations, plus recommendations in each of the four areas. And I'm going to tell you about them. So here are the core recommendations. Transparency is such an important issue here, both in terms of getting companies to report relevant data, for the state to organize it in a way that ordinary citizens can access it, which is a big challenge, it turns out, and so as to inform the public of what's going on. And we underscored the importance of that. Our state DEP had staffed up a lot to deal with shale gas development. But who knew how much, you know, whether that's enough? And there was no way for anybody to know, even experts to know. So what we were pushing here was the importance of the DEP creating parameters and metrics, saying, you know, to be well-staffed, you should have one professional, one inspector for every 100 permits issued, or something like that. I have no idea what it should be. Something that would give us a way to judge whether the staffing was adequate, and to make sure that there was a budget available to support it. Regrettably, we do not have a severance tax in Pennsylvania. Our governor ran on a platform of no new taxes, including severance tax. And I think he immediately regretted it when he was elected. But so what we developed instead was an impact fee. It's too bad. That's another question we can fight about, or I could get angry about. This fourth one, STRONGER, is an acronym that relates to a review and accreditation program for state environmental organizations. Pennsylvania has participated in this, and we're just saying that they should continue to. This fifth one deals with the fact that we have a very outdated law as it relates to oil and gas development in Pennsylvania, which I'll say a little more about. It goes back to 1961, has not really been updated since. And one artifact of it is the only sort of advisory board, the only source of information or advice the DEP gets from outside of itself comes from this advisory board, which was specified in law to consist of five geologists. Now, nothing against geologists. I love geologists, and it's very obviously very important to have geologists advising the DEP, but they need more than that. And so we proposed expanding it. Now, let me spend some time talking about this next one, number six, which in a lot of ways I consider to be one of our, maybe our most significant recommendation. And it's the one we've made most progress on in terms of actually seeing something happen, implementing it. This recommendation was motivated by sort of two observations. One is there simply is not enough funding. Well, there's not enough research going on, and that's because there's not enough funding to support it related to shale gas development. Number two, research that has been performed tends to be judged biased based on who funds it. So if industry funds it, it's very likely that environmental groups will say, well, it's obviously biased because Chevron paid for it. As you know, there are instances where if an environmentally oriented foundation funds work, industry will reject it out of hand because it's obviously biased for that reason. This is not a new phenomenon in the environmental world. It's been the case for decades. And in fact, there was a precedent or a model that we used for our key recommendation. That model is something called the Health Effects Institute, which was founded about 35 years ago. It's based in Boston. It was founded because of the battles at that time between the auto companies and environmental groups over air quality, air pollution from vehicles and the impact on human health. And the same thing was going on. If the auto companies paid for the research, it was biased, et cetera, et cetera. The Health Effects Institute was created with a funding stream based on equal funding from the auto industry and from the government. And they've kept to that model ever since. They've also developed a very high quality and rigorous review process, both at the front end in choosing which proposals to fund, and in the back end in reviewing publications before they go out. They built a great reputation. Their research is really beyond repute in terms of its bias or not. And we think that's a great idea for shale gas. So we have proposed creating a research fund built on that model. And I don't think I'm breaking a confidence when I tell you that the Health Effects Institute is on the verge of launching a year-long project where they will create a research agenda for a future research fund. In the meantime, we'll be trying to raise the money from industry, from environmental, from foundations, and from government. And in the hopes that when they're done writing that agenda, the Health Effects Institute will take on the management of a shale gas research fund, just as they did, just as they have for the last 35 years in the era of air quality. This would be a great addition to the scene. NETL stands for the National Energy Technology Laboratory. That's DOE's fossil fuel lab. You probably are surprised to hear there is such a thing because it's sort of a weak sister of the DOE labs. It's in Pittsburgh and Morgantown, West Virginia, and it's an important resource for us in the region and nationally, and it needs to be strengthened. And then the importance of best management practices. Those are the eight overarching recommendations. Just let me very quickly talk about the four. I talked about research. That was one of the four. There are three more to go. One is modernization of the conservation law that I talked about from 1961. It's got so many curiosities to it based on the fact that it's over 50 years old and so much has changed since then. So as an expedient, for example, when they wrote this law, certain aspects of the law apply to the subsurface above a certain distance below the surface of the land, and others apply below that level. So the effect of that is, if you're working in the Marcellus Shale, you face one set of regulations. If you are working in the Utica formation underneath it, it's a different set. Clearly, an unintended consequence of an old law. So that's the sort of thing that needs to be updated. We're also very squishy about things like unitization. Many of you know what that means. So this is the idea of pooling together leases, very controversial issue. And there needs to be clarity about this and how that works. Anyhow, it's a law that needs attention. Of course, water is a big issue wherever fracking, wherever shale gas is developed. We've got all the issues everybody else has. Water sourcing is probably the least of our issues just because we're a very water-rich region. But nevertheless, you know, there are localities, small streams that could be negatively affected, especially in low flow. So I'm not going to take time for this because these will be coming up again in a minute. And then finally, what we call midstream recommendations. This is a very interesting topic, and it's the one that deals most with the economic benefits from shale gas development in Southwest Pennsylvania. We don't have the infrastructure you would find in producing areas with a longer history, and certainly not the infrastructure you would find in, say, the Gulf Coast or in Texas. That's no surprise. One consequence of that is the gas produced in our region now almost all leaves our region. It goes into an interstate pipeline and generally headed towards the Gulf. And that's understandable. So the question we're asking here is, how can our region capture more of the economic benefit from the gas itself? How can it be used to spur industry in our region? One thing you need to do that is midstream infrastructure, the kinds of pipelines and processing facilities we don't have. That's one aspect of it. But there's another part of this, which is, who would have thought? So suppose you've got two companies producing gas in these two locations, and they both have to send their gas over there. The thing that makes sense, of course, is to have a single pipeline to do that. Obviously, less surface disturbance, environmental impact, and less cost, for that matter. We have no mechanism either for those companies to get together to cooperate, because they're afraid of antitrust law, nor do we have state law or state regulations that allow us to compel them to do so. And that needs to have attention. So we're kind of like getting in our own way, shooting ourselves in the foot. That's what we mean about the midstream. And I have to say, this is the area we've probably made the least progress on, because it's so hard to get the companies to talk together, not because they don't want to, but because they're very worried about being viewed as colluding, coming back to bite them. Plus, the kinds of investments one needs to have a competitive infrastructure for this is very substantial and very expensive. So, enough said. That was the Institute of Politics of the University of Pittsburgh roundtable. After it issued its report in last summer, it went out of business. We were not appointed by anybody. We were self-appointed, so no one's got to listen to our recommendations. The research recommendation is one that has made the most progress because we took it upon ourselves to push it forward. The other ones are getting attention, but not moving forward as quickly. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about is the Center for Sustainable Shale Development, or CSSD. This is quite a different animal. This social license to operate is an important catchphrase that they adopted. And it really comes from the industry more than anybody else, recognizing that if they don't do shale gas right, they won't have the license to operate, even if they have legally. This is founded by a group of companies and environmental groups, major national ones like Shell and Chevron, global ones, Environmental Defense Fund, the Clean Air Task Force. The board, which I chair, is made up of similarly a diverse group, a representative group. So Shell, Chevron, EQT, and CONSOL are represented on it, as is EDF, Clean Air Task Force, and the Pennsylvania Environmental Council. By our own charter, we have to have an equal number of industrial and environmental board members. We're short an environmental one because the president of the Heinz Endowments, who was filling that seat, left his position, and now we're in the process of filling it. There are four more, including me, who are viewed as non-aligned or independent. And so Jane Long, who some of you know, prominent researcher, Paul O'Neill, the former Treasury Secretary, and Christy Todd Whitman, the former EPA Administrator and Governor of New Jersey, are also members, and they're active members, I'm glad to say. And they are because they view this activity as very important, as do I. This in no way was a mandate for this, but what we're doing is very much in line with what the Energy Secretary's Advisory Board recommended, or a subcommittee recommended. This idea of continuous improvement based on specific metrics that covers the entire range of operations and involves non-industry people as well as industry. That's just what we're trying to do. A working group was formed in 2011 of not the board members I identified, but sort of people who are more in the trenches, again, from the same companies and the environmental groups. And they hammered out standards, which the board eventually adopted. They used existing regulations and current practice as sort of their point of departure. And the assignment they took on was basically, how do we make this as high as current practice allows, getting industry to agree to it and environmental groups to agree to it? And this is serious business because, as EDF especially found out when we made one of our announcements, this is very much is getting a lot of attention, and people are not at all hesitant to pile on and accuse EDF, in the case of, in their case of greenwashing, the companies, in the case of sort of giving in to regulation and promoting even stricter regulation by other companies. The idea then is to have a set of standards as high as possible. I'll say more about them in a minute, as well as a certification process based on a third-party independent audit. Not only a office audit, but a field audit of actual operations by the company. And if they meet the standards, then they can be certified as having met the standards of the CSSD, which we hope over time will become almost required to be allowed to operate. But again, we have no authority to do this. It's sort of doing it ourselves. We've got two sets of standards, 8 water standards, groundwater standards, water standards, 7 air standards. They're very detailed. Every one of them is at least as strict or as high as the most strict state regulation of 3 states, because that's the region we're looking at, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia. And in many cases, quite a bit stricter. So for example, wastewater recycling, at least 90%. There is no such requirement in any of those 3 states. But a company that is to be get certified by CSSD must do that. It covers every aspect of the fracking water use cycle. And the intention, and everybody says all the right things whenever we're together, but only time will tell, is that not only are we starting with a high bar, we think, we recognize we've yet to actually put these into practice. We've only talked about them. That's about to happen, though. We're about to go live. That as we learn about actual operation, vis-a-vis these standards. There's a commitment to always be looking for ways to make the standards even higher, to keep pushing actual practice up higher. Those are the water standards. There are air standards. These have as much or more to do with the equipment you use, including trucks, at a fracking site, as it does with the gas itself. Of course, as we know, leaks from this system are very important. It's been observed that if you view shale gas, again, as I posited as a replacement for coal, in terms of its climate change impacts or its contribution to CO2 concentrations, it's an advantage because you get about half the amount of CO2 from gas combustion as you do from coal. But if there are significant leaks in the system, that negates or even worse makes gas worse than coal in terms of its CO2 contribution. So leaks are a big part of these standards also. As I said, there's an accreditation and certification process. We have now contracted with a third-party auditor. We've set out the protocols. The first company is in the process of preparing its application to us. And it's one of the board members, which shouldn't be a surprise. And we will go forward. And hopefully by the end of this year, I hope earlier than that, we will have been through our first audit and certification process, and hopefully a company will be certified. These four companies that are members of the board and our founders are obviously committed to this. No other company is publicly. The whole idea, of course, is to make this so compelling that, you know, these four will meet the certification. We hope they do. If they don't, they have to make corrections. That ultimately they will, and this will put pressure on the rest of the industry to join in. But we'll see. This is the risk we're taking. So, again, the context, sort of the angle from which I'm approaching this is, fracking is happening. How do we make it as environmentally acceptable as possible and as economically advantageous as possible? Two activities. One was sort of a citizen activity to identify areas where we can improve mostly state regulation and the state of research. And the other is a cooperative effort between industry and environmental groups. If nothing else, this does demonstrate that the two sides, if you will, or at least these participants in the two sides, can work together, can identify common ground. And, you know, only time will tell. I don't have results to show you, but hopefully set the stage for a real improvement in the practice of shale gas development. Thank you very much for your attention and again for having me here. I'll be happy to answer questions and hear your comments. Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.